NPR News, Tucson.
Toyota said today it will adjust car and truck production to reflect changing demand for pickup trucks, small cars, and hybrids. Toyota says it will produce its fuel-efficient hybrid Prius car at a planned Mississippi plant instead of an SUV model, and it says it will consolidate full-size pickup truck production at one Texas plant in the spring of next year. It will stop making the big trucks at an Indiana factory. Wachovia Bank has named Treasury Undersecretary Robert Steele as its new chief executive. Steele succeeds Ken Thompson. He was ousted by the board last month as Wachovia's losses on bad loans mounted. I'm Paul Brown, and this is NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Saturn, introducing the Aura XE four-cylinder, a sports sedan that gets an EPA-estimated 30 miles per gallon highway. More at Saturn.com.
WILL programming is made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, featuring locally grown and organic produce, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar, and bulk foods department. Strawberry Fields also offers natural vitamins, health and beauty products, household cleaning products, pet foods, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Programs on WILL are made possible in part by the 6th Annual Sugar Creek Symphony and Song, presenting Donizetti's The Elixir of Love, August 1st through the 3rd, in the renovated Art Deco Watsika Theater in Watsika, Illinois, an opera about love, money, and a magic potion. More information at sugarcreekfestival.org.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. This morning, in the first hour of the show, we will look back to the politics of America in the late 60s and early 70s. Back in 1964, Democratic presidential candidate Lyndon Johnson won practically the biggest landslide in American history. In 1972, now this was just 8 years later, Republican presidential candidate Richard Nixon won a very similar landslide. How was it that American politics could have changed so much in just 8 years? Our guest for this hour of Focus 580, historian Rick Perlstein, says that in part, perhaps in large part, the agent of that change was Nixon himself. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with Rick Perlstein about his recent book, Nixonland. The subtitle is The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America. He makes the argument that Nixon used the anger and anxiety that existed in America, stirred up by the social upheaval of the time, he used that to divide the country and, argues our guest, that division persists to this day. The book is recently out. It's published by Scribner, so you can look for it in the bookstore. Our guest is the author of another book dealing with some of the same kind of material and what was going on in America around the same time. That book, Before the Storm, Barry Goldwater and the Unmaking of the American Consensus. That book won the 2001 Los Angeles Times Book Prize for History and also appeared on the best books list of a number of papers that Times, New York Times, The Washington Post, The Chicago Tribune. He's also published essays and reviews in a number of places, including The Times, The Post, The Nation, The Village Voice, and Slate. He is now a senior fellow at the Campaign for America's Future, and he's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of people who call in is just that they try to keep their comments brief, so we can keep moving, but anyone is welcome to call 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Perlstein, hello.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. I actually did some of my research at the U of I Library.
Well, it would be a good place for it, so I appreciate you spending some of your time with us. Just as a way of starting out, to remind folks of the atmosphere of the time, this was a time when America was dividing into essentially two camps, a bitter division, and people who, politically at least, people who saw everything about as differently as they possibly could. And the one thing that perhaps these two sides in this divide had in common was that they felt that if the other side had their way, it would destroy the country.
That's it. That's the condition I call Nixonland. And, you know, just last night I was doing an online chat with some fans of the movie Bonnie and Clyde, you know, that came out in 1967. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was a perfect example. It was just a movie. But it's inspired this colossal debate. There were like four, five, six articles about it in the New York Times about whether it was this absolute or immoral sign of the collapse of civilization, which was the position of the New York Times longtime film critic Bosley Crowther, or whether it was the harbinger of a new, better morality, which a lot of the young people were arguing. In fact, their letters to Time magazine in my book saying, well, the reason why college kids gave Bonnie and Clyde a standing ovation and their parents walked out of the theater was because these two generations just have a fundamentally different morality. It's stunning how the divisions of society just got down to the capillary level and swept every corner of the society, even the movie houses.
Mm-hmm. And as far as Richard Nixon was concerned, certainly no one would make the argument that he created these divisions. But what you're saying is that what he and the people who worked on his campaigns realized was that this was something that they could turn to their advantage.
Right. You used the word agent. And he wasn't quite the agent. He didn't create the wave, but he certainly did surf the wave. And he certainly did intensify the wave, and quite deliberately. I mean, my favorite example is right after he was inaugurated, he got a memo on his desk. This was 1969, and the memo said, this spring, the campus protests are going to be more violent and more intense and more impassionate than they ever have before, more divisive. And he wrote across the memo, good. And that one word, good, spoke volumes. He loved the idea of staging dramatic confrontations between these two Americas because his bet, his political bet, was that he could use them to split the country in two and end up with the bigger half of the country. Mm-hmm. He was quite explicit about this in private and even sometimes in public.
Now, I suppose some people would make the argument that this was simply a cynical manipulation of politics as they were in the country, and in fact, it may be that that's what it was. But at the same time, would you agree that that Nixon himself felt that he was very solidly in one of these camps?
And well, he thought he was doing the right thing.
He thought he was doing essentially. He thought he was doing the right thing.
Absolutely. This is a very important part of the book, and there's a fascinating evolution to this because he believed himself a warrior for what was really kind of truth, justice, and the American way by taking one of these sides in the culture war. I mean, he thought that the people who were tearing up the campuses were, like you said, the enemies of America, going to destroy America. Now, the fascinating part of the dynamic that set into motion was that the passions got so intense and the mutual recrimination and paranoia got so intense that you can attribute a lot of what happened with the Watergate scandal and the kind of corner cutting and justifies the means thinking that we saw from Nixon in the run-up to the 1972 election and even before, since he became president when he started spying on people and tapping phones and things like that, as the belief that he was saving the world, that he was doing the right thing. And one of the arguments I make in my book is that the American people didn't deliver Richard Nixon this gargantuan landslide in 1972 despite the fear and dread that gave us Watergate, but in a certain sense because of it, that he was giving off these signals that he was going to fight these bastards any way it took. And if that meant, cutting some corners and breaking some laws, he was willing to do it. And people really identified with that, some people.
Now, there's been a lot written about Richard Nixon and about his personality. I don't know that the book it's not intended to be. It is not a biography of Richard Nixon. But you can't really talk about this time and him and these campaigns without saying something about his personality. And it does indeed look as if the feeling that he had, maybe a lifelong feeling, or at least going back to the time when he was young, this feeling of being an outsider.
Absolutely.
Of being one of these people who, was confronting a glass ceiling where the people above him, the people of privilege, the people who had the advantages, managed to rise, and he somehow felt that he was always the guy who was bumping his head against the the ceiling. That kind of feeling seems to have been something that that drove him and maybe drove him substantially through a lot of his life.
That's absolutely true. And it started very early. He was always the smartest kid. He was always a lonely, isolated kid. And it really kind of came to a head. Well, if you want to even go back to his early upbringing, I say that the formula for a successful presidential candidate, and this goes for pretty much all our successful presidents, is you need a mother who will tell you that you can accomplish anything, and a kind of an emotionally distant father who tells you that nothing you accomplish can ever be enough to please him. And that certainly was Nixon's condition. And he worked three times harder than anyone else. And by the time he was getting ready to go to college, he won a scholarship from this little, you know, California town called Whittier to go to Harvard. And he was all set to go. But his family couldn't afford the train tickets back and forth. They couldn't afford the rent, room, and board. So once again, he saw kind of lesser lights kind of pass him by. And that really kind of became sort of the dynamic part of his political style. And by the time he was taking on the communist infiltration of the State Department in the late 40s, he very much framed the people who had let this happen, the kind of cultural aristocrats in America, the people like the Dean Achesons and the Avril Harrimans and the striped pants diplomats of the State Department, as the people who had snubbed him earlier in life. And then by the time we got to the 60s, you see these same kind of so-called cultural elites kind of embracing the social changes of the 60s, or at least saying if you're cool, if you're with it, that you would embrace these cultural changes too. And that was the same sort of feeling of being looked down one's nose upon that he appealed to in the 1960s. And in fact, to extend the metaphor, I have this kind of extended metaphor through the whole book. When he did go to Whittier College, this little school in California, he tried to join the one fraternity that all the cool kids belonged to, and they wouldn't let him in. So he started his own fraternity. He called it the Orthogonians. And his own fraternity turned out to be more powerful than the cool kids' fraternity, because there's more uncool people than cool people. It's a great way to build a political base. That really is kind of the template for his entire career, and culminating in 1969 with a famous speech in which he gave this kind of group the name the Silent Majority.
Mm-hmm. This was his feeling, which really turned out to be true, that there were other people out there who had that same sort of, perhaps came from that same sort of background, or at least had that same sort of feeling.
Everyone feels snubbed by somebody.
Yeah, yeah. And if he could get those people on his side, then that would be...
Yeah, he's kind of them, but also apart from them. He's always expanding the circle. I mean, he's creating the sense of grievance that he's, again, harvesting, but he's always kind of like apart from them as their leader. Yeah. And the people who's giving them a voice to speak to their own frustrations.
Just maybe one more big point here, and I think it's also something that you're interested in getting people to think about, a point you want to make, and that is when people think about the key figures in American conservatism, in the past few decades, and the people who were really responsible for the rise of the right in American politics, I'm sure on most people's list there are two guys, Barry Goldwater and Ronald Reagan. And
right.
I think that what you're interested in is saying, well, you're really overlooking the significance in the rise of the right politically in the United States. You're overlooking the significance of Richard Nixon.
Well, it's a very complicated question because, as everyone knows, Richard Nixon, in the terms of some of the policies he proposed, especially some of the domestic policies, was more liberal than even some Democrats today.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of foreign policy, he championed détente, which meant, you know, talking to the Soviets, you know, talking to the Chinese, and that very much was what the conservative movement in the 70s kind of consolidated around opposing. But by the same token, this rhetorical approach that there's a liberal elite that's looking down their nose at you, that disdains your values, that thinks that you're bitter and cling to your guns and, you know, cling to your religion, is absolutely crucial to the rise of conservatism as a political force. And by the same token, was really Richard Nixon in his heart of hearts a conservative? I think there's evidence that he was. I mean, he was quite politically pragmatic. I mean, what he really cared about was power and control. But there's this famous moment in 1970 where his attorney general and later his campaign manager in 1972 is drunk in a party. And he says to a reporter, "This country is going so far to the right, you're not even going to recognize it." You know, had Richard Nixon had a clear field in 1973 to run his presidency the way he wished, I think he would have went far to the right. But he was so busy saving his presidency, he really couldn't take the country in any kind of direction he wanted to.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Rick Perlstein. He's an historian. He's the author of the book Before the Storm, Barry Goldwater and the Unmaking of the American Consensus, and a brand new book that is titled Nixon Land. The subtitle is The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America, and it's published by Scribner. Questions, comments, welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. I think one still, it amazes when you look back at Nixon's political career, and you certainly look at where he was and what people thought about him after he lost to John Kennedy.
That's right.
Even more so after
he lost to Pat Brown in 1970.
Yeah, you know, the fact that the guy could come back from those kinds of defeats, it seems remarkable.
Yes, and that in maybe even a perverse way kind of makes him a hero of the book too, and someone that, you know, it's kind of very easy to admire from a certain angle because he was despised and looked down upon by all the elites of society to an astonishing degree. I mean, he lost that race in 1960 by the closest margin of any presidential race up to that point. In 1962, he's kind of looking to keep his political career alive, and by the way, trying to keep him out of the running for the 1964 presidential election because he hated the king of the snobs, JFK, so much they didn't want to run against him. So he runs for governor of California in 1962, and that's supposed to be kind of a clear shot. The idea that he couldn't win a governorship after almost winning the presidency would have been absurd, but he ends up losing to Pat Brown. And that's when he gives his famous last press conference. He says, "You're not going to have Richard Nixon to kick around anymore because this is my last press conference." ABC TV puts on a very humiliating, very patronizing show called The Political Obituary of Richard Nixon, in which they literally have as one of the talking heads, you know, Alger Hiss, you know, the communist spy that Richard Nixon had been able to put in jail. So I say, you know, Alger Hiss was doing better in polite society than Richard Nixon. And even as late as the middle of 1967, when Time magazine is getting ready to do a cover article about his comeback and how he's running for the Republican presidential nomination in 1968, the editors still can't quite take him seriously as a political contender, and they pull the cover story at the last minute. The idea of Richard Nixon as president of the United States was an absurdity almost until it happened.
Well, did people on the right ever really become comfortable with him? Did they?
Well, they kind of blew hot and cold. I mean, he worked very hard at cultivating them in a political constituency, especially in the key year of 1966, the key year of his comeback. But no, I mean, in 1968, National Review swallowed their compunctions and backed him to the hilt, and then basically the narrative that the conservatives spoke about regarding Richard Nixon was one of betrayal, and he betrayed his conservative campaign promises. I mean, if you look at his nomination speech at the convention in 1968, Ronald Reagan could have delivered that speech. There's no question it was a conservative speech. But then again, we forget that the conservatives were talking about how they were betrayed by Ronald Reagan all through his term too. So there's in conservatism itself, there's always this theme of purity and betrayal. And so by 1972, a lot of conservatives are questioning him as a champion of their cause. But by the same token, Jesse Helms, who had excoriated him as a radio commentator in the early 70s for appeasing China and things like that, was perfectly happy to run as a Nixonian Republican in 1972. And then when Watergate hit the fan and his presidency was in jeopardy, conservatives really rallied around him because they saw him as, if the liberals hate him, he must be doing something right. So it's a very complicated question. And one that kind of gets to the core of what conservatives are in American history, in a lot of ways speaking to this culture of kind of white middle class grievance, this idea that the liberals are out to get us.
I think that certainly there are a lot of people on the left who couldn't find anything positive to say about
Richard Nixon. Well, that's the interesting thing. I mean, in a lot of ways, the weaknesses of liberalism in the 1950s, after kind of the New Deal agenda was largely in place, and there didn't seem to be a lot of work to do in terms of policy, really kind of centered on kind of hating Richard Nixon and all he represented. Mm-hmm. And that was a real blind alley for the left and for liberalism, because it basically kind of cultivated just the kind of snobbery that Richard Nixon was so good at exploiting. I mean, if you read the liberal responses to the Checker speech, which is this famous televised speech he gave in 1952 to try to, get back on the Eisenhower ticket after he was supposedly enmeshed in scandal, the dominant response of liberals was, how could anyone possibly believe what this guy is selling? You know, 1962, the liberal slogan was, would you buy a used car from this man? And the fact of the matter is, the telegrams that came into the Republican National Committee were 99% favorable to Nixon. So liberals were not able to grasp what in Richard Nixon's presentation was so appealing to so many Americans. And because they were so wrapped up in this idea that he was kind of déclassé and embarrassing and sentimental, and it really kind of blunted liberalism's ability to understand the kind of genuine grievances, cultural grievances, that Richard Nixon spoke to all throughout his career.
I think that there are some people who would argue that the great genius here of the campaign, maybe not so much his, but of people around him, like Pat Buchanan, for example, was to realize that there were people in America who had previously voted Democrat, who were, though, much more in sympathy with the kind of values maybe and the kind of concerns that were on Nixon and the Orthonian side of the Orthogonian side of the political divide, and that it would be possible to peel those people away from the Democratic Party. And these are the people that I suppose later came to be called, maybe some of them would have been called Reagan Democrats.
Absolutely. And they even talked about the Goldwater Democrats as early as 1964, but it was really Nixon who picked up that ball, and again, quite explicitly. I mean, there are memos in the book from his main political aide, Chuck Colson, saying, you know, that there had been something called the Hard Hat Riot. Are you familiar with that?
No.
In May of 1970, after the Kent State shootings, when there were protests all over the country, one of the anti-war protests was in Lower Manhattan, actually, on Wall Street.
Oh, yes, right.
And the protest begins, and it's a rainy day, so the flags aren't flying in front of Federal Hall. And these construction workers start accusing these hippies of stealing the flag. It really, the flag wasn't flying because of the inclement weather. That was the flag code. And suddenly this mob of 500 construction workers starts beating the anti-war protesters with their hard hats. And then the Wall Street traders leave the stock exchange and start joining in. And the police kind of step aside and watch it happen. And it was a remarkable movement. It was almost like a fascist movement in American history. But lo and behold, Richard Nixon invites Peter Brennan, who is the head of the construction workers unions in New York City, to the White House. It's almost like a celebratory event. And Peter Brennan presents him with an honorary hard hat reading commander-in-chief. And it's right around the time you literally begin to see these memos saying, we can win union voters without doing anything for them economically. We don't have to support union policies. We can just appeal to their patriotism. We can just appeal to their cultural grievances. We can just appeal to their anger at all these social changes that are going on. And it's quite explicit, because no one had really thought of it that way before. If you wanted to get union voters, you had to give concessions to union politics. But Richard Nixon really invented this new way of appealing, although it wasn't precisely new. It was kind of pioneered by Ronald Reagan, especially in his 1966 governor's campaign, when he completely shocked the liberal pundits by giving all these speeches at factories, and union workers just would give him standing ovations when he would talk about all the people cheating on welfare and all the kids burning down the campuses. And that's the kind of politics that, has been proved remarkably enduring for the Republican Party. I mean, John McCain just came out with his first general election campaign commercial, and it includes pictures of kids cavorting at Woodstock, while he's, doing his patriotic duty in the Hanoi Hilton. This has become an enormous part of how the Republicans make their basic appeal to the American people now.
Mm. We have a caller here to bring into the conversation, someone who's listening in Champaign, so we'll go to them on line number one. Hello.
Yes. How does Richard Nixon's Southern strategy factor into his personality?
His personality? Well, of course, politically it was enormously important because, of course, the South was – they were habitual Democratic voters. They talked about the Democratic solid South, and the reason for that was the Democratic Party was a very uncomfortable, unstable coalition between literally Southern segregationists and Northern liberals. So Nixon exploited that wedge. How did it speak to his personality? That's a really rich question. Because the South, as a region, I call it, you know, I speak of the Orthogonians. That was that fraternity for the uncool kids in college that Richard Nixon started. The South, in a lot of ways, is an Orthogonian region. It always feels lectured to and patronized by the North. In fact, when Franklin Roosevelt decided that the South's lagging economic development was this huge national problem that had to be taken care of and released a report on that, the South responded by saying, "Why are you looking down your nose at us? We're just as good as you are." So, I mean, the South and Richard Nixon exploited that kind of psychological complex among Southerners when he nominated a Southerner for Supreme Court, who turned out to be corrupt and didn't get the nomination. His name was Haynsworth. And then he nominated another Southerner immediately afterwards named Carswell, who wasn't nominated because basically it was proven that he had been a segregationist only very shortly earlier. When these two Supreme Court nominees were turned back by the Senate, Richard Nixon gave one of his angriest and most passionate TV speeches, and he said it was an act of regional bigotry against the South. So this idea that he was kind of rescuing the South from the cultural condescension of the North and the liberals was something that he was almost born to do.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. Others are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Our guest is Rick Perlstein. His new book is Nixon Land, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America. The book is published by Scribner. He's also author of the book Before the Storm, Barry Goldwater and the Unmaking of the American Consensus. Won a lot of recognition in 2001. Won the LA Times Book Prize for History. Appeared on the best book lists of the New York Times, Washington Post, the Chicago Tribune. He's also contributed essays and reviews to The Times, The Post, The Nation, The Village Voice, and Slate, among other publications. He is now a senior fellow at the Campaign for America's Future. Questions again, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. In 1968, when Nixon won, this was a very narrow victory.
Another very narrow victory. He got about 43% of the vote, in fact.
And here this was, there were three candidates. Nixon, Hubert Humphrey was the Democratic Party's candidate, and George Wallace was running as an independent. And I suppose some people might ask this question, had it not been for Wallace, would Nixon have won? And was there some kind of connection between Nixon and the Republicans and George Wallace?
That's one of the richest and most complex and fascinating threads that's kind of woven throughout the whole book. George Wallace was kind of the rightermost edge that allowed Richard Nixon to basically make quite similar appeals that George Wallace made in more polite language and look like a moderate. He was basically Nixon triangulated between George Wallace and the liberals. And George Wallace, of course, was this absolutely passionate segregationist from Alabama, who had most famously stood in the schoolhouse door in 1963. He ran a test run for presidency in 1964 and did shockingly well in three primaries in northern states, Indiana, Wisconsin, and the third one escapes me. And then he ran for president in 1968, and he was as high as 20% in the polls. Now, why was he as high as 20% in the polls? He would give a rally at a place like Madison Square Garden. And recently in the news, a protester had laid down in front of Lyndon Johnson's limousine. And George Wallace would stand up at this rally, shout at the top of his lungs, that the first protester who lays down in my limousine is going to get run over. And then there would be a standing ovation. He absolutely reveled in exploiting the basest rages that people had about the social change in the 1960s. And him and Nixon had a very complicated relationship since George Wallace had almost cost him the presidency in 1968 because basically had all those angry former Democratic voters voted for Nixon instead of Wallace, it would have been a landslide. So there's this great political drama in which Nixon expends enormous energy behind the scenes trying to get to neutralize George Wallace politically. And he eventually succeeds by almost literally bribing him to run in 1972, not as a third-party candidate, as he had in 1968, but as a Democrat. So this is part of Richard Nixon's strategy to win the 1972 election, is basically to seed the Civil War within the Democratic Party. And once George Wallace is running as a Democrat and saying that the Democratic Party has betrayed you, they want to bus black people into your neighborhoods, that the party of the hippies, they're the party of the people who are, you know, destroying America's moral fiber, it happened exactly as Richard Nixon planned. There was a civil war within the Democratic Party. And, in fact, George Wallace won the Democratic primary in Florida, which was the first big Democratic primary of 1972, and in second place with was George McGovern. And when you think about how different their appeals are, George Wallace and George McGovern, you see how successful Richard Nixon was in absolutely seeding this civil war within the Democratic Party for his 1972 race. Hmm. It's a long answer, but it's a very rich yeah. theme in this history.
How would you? I wonder how would you respond? And I'm sure that some people would say that. And in fact, I just yesterday I was looking at this clip from MSNBC where you were on. You were talking about the book, and you were going back and forth with Pat Buchanan. Some people, I suppose, would say that a big reason for Nixon's success was that the Democratic Party, the candidates they fielded, were just not very strong candidates.
Yes, and that's not true. That's what Pat Buchanan would like to believe. Richard Nixon was absolutely terrified of running against the guy who was the Democrats' strongest candidate. That was a guy named Edmund Muskie, who had been the vice presidential candidate in 1968, and it proved very successful in 1968 in speaking to both kinds of Democrats, both anti-war and kind of backlash Democrats. And Nixon spent enormous energy in sabotaging Edmund Muskie's political viability. I mean, he had a 24-hour surveillance on him ever since 1970. He had spies in Edmund Muskie's campaign, so they were, you know, sending campaign memos to the press. And a huge part of what would later become Watergate was this strategy that you cannot say on a family radio show that begins with rat and ends with an obscenity, which was the Nixon campaign's technique of basically doing things like stealing stationery from Democratic campaigns, say like the stationery of the Humphrey campaign. Humphrey was running for the 1972 nomination, writing a letter on Humphrey stationery saying that Edmund Muskie had, you know, fathered a child out of wedlock, and making it look like Edmund Muskie was being smeared by a fellow Democrat when it was really the White House doing the smearing. And, you know, that basically, in a nutshell, was what was the substance of the Watergate scandal, was, you know, Richard Nixon's attempt to cheat in the 1972 election. And the substance of it was to try and knock out all the candidates that he would be most successful for the Democrats, Edmund Muskie, Hubert Humphrey. And the guy he wanted to run against was the furthest left candidate, and that was George McGovern. And that was the only guy whose campaign they didn't sabotage. McGovern did turn out to be a very weak candidate, largely because he was so principled, he didn't have a chance against a gutter fighter like Richard Nixon. And that was exactly as Richard Nixon planned it.
All right, let's talk with someone else in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
A fascinating discussion. Regarding Nixon, did he, 2 points here, did he ever feel it you know, kind of odd or express a kind of any emotion on the fact that he was, in fact, in the party of Lincoln, but at this time was courting racial segregationists. And personally, was he a racist and an anti-Semite?
Wow, what a great question. In the 1950s, as vice president, he was actually known as a supporter of civil rights. He had spoken warmly about Martin Luther King, and, of course, this was the party of Lincoln. I mean, Republican votes were the key votes in passing the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and 1965. Quite politically opportunistic, he rode the other side of the fence, but he did it in a very cunning way. All through the years he was president, he said, you know, it's fully our intention to enforce all the civil rights laws to the hilt. That's what he would say in public, but literally would say in private to people like Strom Thurmond that he was undermining those very laws. So he was very sensitive to the idea that you could not be seen as a racist and be successful in this period of American history. What were his true thoughts about black people? They were revealed in a very stunning entry in the diary of his key aide, Haldeman, that was published. The diary was published in the late 80s, I believe, but in an expurgated version. They later came out with a CD-ROM version, which had Haldeman's full diaries. And Haldeman said the boss was ranting again about his theory about, you know, the genetic inferiority of blacks. So apparently that's what he believed in his heart of hearts, and he was willing to play it politically, whatever gave him the most advantage at any particular given moment. They told the South, watch what we do, not what we say.
I see. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. We have about 10, 12 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Rick Perlstein. He's the author of the new book, Nixonland, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America. It looks at American politics from the sort of the mid-60s to the early 70s. It's just recently been published. He's also author of a book about Barry Goldwater, that's Before the Storm, Barry Goldwater and the Unmaking of the American Consensus. Questions here, welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Given the fact that he really took advantage of the split in America over the war, was definitely saw himself as opposed to the anti-war side of this split. How was it then he spun the withdrawal of the United States from Vietnam?
Yes, yet more cunning. I mean, he was a very, very cunning and shrewd politician. And I mentioned the silent majority speech before. That was the one where he basically gave a name to this constituency that he'd been courting, you know, sedulously since 1948. That speech was fascinating, because what he was doing on a policy level in that speech, which was given in November of 1969, was announcing his new policy of Vietnamization, which basically meant steady cuts in the troop presence in Vietnam, basically a timetable for withdrawal, we would say, in today's argot. Even as he was saying, the people who had been urging that same course on him in the streets were not quite Americans. I mean, it's an absolute stunning speech, an absolute amazing rhetorical performance, because by that time the Vietnam War was absolutely unpopular. But the only thing that was more unpopular than the Vietnam War were the Vietnam War protesters, who were seen as, you know, anti-American. You know, they made their own bed. I mean, this is after, you know, things like the Days of Rage, where you had the weathermen raging through the streets of Chicago and breaking windows, you know, starting to lay bombs. So he took advantage of the fact that Americans hated the war, but they hated the anti-warriors more, to basically turn himself into the anti-warrior that Americans could trust. Now, by the same token, what did he actually do? He did decrease the troop presence, but massively increased the bombing, which was a very, very inhumane policy. And also, he sold out South Vietnam by basically understanding, really as early as 1966, that the war couldn't be won militarily, while excoriating anyone who said that publicly. So by 1972, he's telling Henry Kissinger on these White House tapes, look, we just got to get out and make it look like we made a noble effort, but we know that South Vietnam is going to go to pot. And we need a decent interval between the time Saigon falls and the time we remove our troops. and then we can wash our hands of the thing. It's the cunning and cynicism are absolutely stunning.
Just to bring things forward a little bit, again, to talk about one of the big points here, and I think we talked a little bit about this at the beginning, your argument is that the kind of the cultural political divide that we see going back to at least to the 1960s that Nixon and the Republicans managed to exploit, maybe we have different ways of talking about it now, but it seems that you're saying that you think that essentially that cultural divide and those two signs, they still exist. Maybe now we call them red states and blue states.
Right.
But that essentially it's the same, they are very much the same camps, and the people are continuing to fight about very much the same sorts of things.
Well, they are. And the reality, it's almost like the rhetoric in which we talk about politics is still shaped according to these terms that Richard Nixon's and the battles against, you know, the kind of the battles around Nixon, pro and con, bequeathed to us, even though the reality on the ground is just so very, very different. I mean, in the 60s and the 70s, there literally, you know, were anti-war protesters, you know, laying bombs and abjuring their allegiance to the United States of America. And, you know, one of the things that Republicans have kind of continued to do is cast and recast and recast the Democrats as the handmaidens of those same forces, even though those same forces really don't exist in America in any significant way anymore. In fact, David Frum, who is one of the smarter kind of conservative critics of the conservative movement, says, you know, we've been running the same presidential campaign in 1970 since 1972, and we got to get over it. It's not going to work too much longer. And that's one of the most fascinating questions about this upcoming presidential election, because, as I say, McCain is running the same script. He's running commercials, you know, contrasting the heathenism at Woodstock to his duty in Vietnam. And I get calls from newspaper reporters every day saying, why are they still fighting the Vietnam War as if it had happened yesterday? And sometimes I'm at a loss. It's fascinating. But it was such a traumatic time that I'm writing about that in a way it's not surprising that we're still trying to reckon with it 40 years later, because that's what happened after the Civil War. People were still basically, American politics was still being carried out on terms dictated by the Civil War in the early 20th century.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's fascinating that, you know, perhaps it depends upon what was going on in the country when it was in your formative years. But I don't know, I think about the fact that being here, even on a college campus, and it's been true now for some time, there are students walking around here who weren't even born. You know, for them, this is ancient history.
Oh, they weren't even born when Reagan was elected.
Well, quite so.
And, you know, for me, it's ancient history. I was born in 1969. I like to say, you know, that when Richard Nixon was starting to make a mess in the White House, I was making an even bigger mess, you know, down there in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, you know. But people really do seem to be drawn, historians are often drawn to the period immediately prior to the one in which they were born, you know, the conditions that kind of shaped the world that they were born into. And certainly that's the case for me. I've always been a 60s fanatic. You know, I spent all my time in used bookstores growing up looking for the strangest 60s cultural artifacts I could find. And believe me, the used bookstores did not disappoint, because it was a very, very strange time. Sometimes it still boggles my mind just how strange it was. I mean, I remember one day I was at the Renaissance bookstore in Milwaukee. I mean, when I say I remember, this was 20 years ago. And I remember buying two books in the same day. And one was by a Black Power advocate, and it was called Look Out, Honky, Black Power is Going to Get Your Mama. And on the same day, I bought a book by a right-wing preacher called The Marxist Minstrels and the Communist Subversion of Music, about how the Beatles were a communist plot. Now, when you have people like that trying to share the same nation, you're going to get some stresses, you're going to get some strains, you're going to get some drama. And, you know, that's what I try to convey in this book, Nixon Land, that I came out with this spring.
Yeah. Another caller here in Urbana, line number one. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Do you think it was like lessons learned from the Nixon era that might have anything to do with the fact that there's no anti-war movement for the Iraq War, that if even two people get together and wear a T-shirt denigrates Bush, then they're arrested?
Well, there's a lot of things, ways to go with your question. I think that the powers that be have, yes, been much better at neutralizing the political effect of protest. They have techniques for doing so, you know, like crowd containment techniques. And the 60s was there was just so much more kind of intensity and confidence in every political faction. People were willing to get arrested. But by the same token, one of the reasons that college students were willing to get arrested in the 1960s was they weren't graduating with $20,000 in college debt. I mean, a school like University of Illinois, I don't know how cheap the tuition was, but at the University of California, tuition was free. You know, the economy was just a lot more secure for people trying to enter the middle class. So the risks of protesting weren't nearly as great. And the risks of not protesting seem much higher because, of course, then they had a draft. And it's hard for young people to get their minds around it. But, you know, if I saw, you know, 15, 20-year-olds in the street and said, three of you are about to go to Iraq, whether you like it or not, you know, well, you might start seeing people willing to get arrested to avoid that fate. It's a very different time. The intensity of everyday life in the 60s is, you know, I think, almost unimaginable to us now.
It seems that it certainly in this election cycle that we're in now, the Democratic candidates were working very hard to try to get back those Democrats, that those kinds of people that had been peeled off by the Republicans now all these many years ago. It's not that they hadn't done it previously, but it seems to me that in the kind of appeals that they've been making, particularly to working class people, the effort to try to get those people has been now more intense this time around than ever before.
Yes, and I think it's an idea whose, you know, time has come, because, as I say, you know, how many times can they run commercials about Woodstock and expect people to care? You know, I mean, it was literally 40 years ago. And, you know, the Democrats' basic core appeal, you know, always has been and always will be, as kind of like America's Social Democratic Party, will be to, you know, those in the bottom half of the income distribution. And the fact that the Republicans have been successful, sometimes more so, sometimes less so, in getting those folks to vote for economic policies that actually objectively harm them is one of the great political stories of our age. And it's something that progressives and Democrats are working very hard to reverse. And, you know, this may be the time to do it, because these appeals to people's cultural grievances and their kind of jingoism have turned to a mess of ashes in the Bush administration.
It seems that, at least over the past couple elections, what we've seen here is a country that was very closely divided, that we'd have people who are very solidly committed to one party or another, and that they probably, chances are, they're going to vote for the nominee of that party virtually no matter what. And then in the middle, we have some people who are amenable, who would consider to go. They're persuaded. You know, they'll go one way or another. The swing voters, they'll go one way or another depending on, you know, what it is they're worried about and the appeals they're made to them and so forth. Do you? And I guess I wonder whether you think that we're going to see that pattern continue for the foreseeable future.
Oh, I mean, I think that's basically a fundamental, you know, kind of structure of human consciousness almost. I mean, there are always going to be right-wing people and left-wing people and people in the center, and the people in the center will pass the right-wing threshold or the left-wing threshold depending on kind of what issues are salient in that particular election. Now, given that that's the case, it really looks like the Democrats are advantaged in this particular struggle on this cycle. I mean, the Pew poll people have been measuring people's party identification since the 1970s, and now they're finding that 50% of their respondents either call themselves Democrats or identify with the Democratic program, and only 35% for the Republicans. So, you know, the momentum really does seem to be on the left side of the spectrum at this particular juncture.
Mm-hmm. It's still, I find myself, though, thinking back to your comment about how reporters call and ask you and say things like, why are people still fighting the Vietnam War? When you look at the candidates that we have a man who was a decorated, highly regarded veteran of the Vietnam War, who is still very much connecting with that experience. And then on the Democratic side, we have we had at one point the historic possibility that we either could have the first woman to be the candidate of the party, or we could have the first person of color to be the candidate of the party. And it seems like very much we're got you couldn't draw any more clearly, even though I think that that now we're getting into the general election, and you would have expected, no matter who was the Democratic nominee, that they would want to tiptoe, or maybe more than tiptoe, back over to the center. You couldn't hardly pick a set of candidates that were any more representative of these two sides. That we see going back all the way back to this time that we're talking about.
I think it's true. I mean, I think we haven't seen kind of the conservative vision for America and the progressive vision for America, both kind of culturally and in policy, more starkly presented in any election in our generation. And the fact that the conservative candidate seems to be the party, he's the old man in the party of the past, and the progressive candidate seems to be the young man in the party of the future, really seems to suggest that this conservative era, really, that began with the election of Ronald Reagan, is an eclipse, that we're in a new realignment of forces.
Well, there are certainly people who argue that, and who also and also would talk about the fact that John McCain is also not fully embraced by many people who are on the conservative side, particularly social conservatives, who weren't all that happy with him. And after it looked like he would become the nominee, there were certainly even people who said, well, I don't care if he's the nominee or not, I'm not going to vote for him, and maybe that means I'm not going to vote. And unhappiness with the Bush administration and so many of the things that it's done. What do you think, in fact, that says about where American conservatism is now?
Well, it's a profound disarray, and the smartest conservatives recognize this. I mean, every other day a new book comes out about the disarray in the Republican coalition. And, you know, some of the writers deal with it forthrightly, but mostly they make excuses. They say, well, Bush really failed because he betrayed conservatism. Again, this ideology of betrayal, and, you know, this ideology of purity and betrayal. And they don't really know what to do. They don't really know where to go. And a lot of this has to do with the fact that, you know, the bill is frankly coming due on a lot of conservative policies. I mean, I was following very closely the bridge collapse story in Minneapolis in August of 2007. You know, one of the biggest, most traveled bridges just fell into the Mississippi River, and a dozen people died. Well, immediately prior to that, the governor of Minnesota, who, by the way, is being considered for the vice presidency by John McCain, vetoed a highway construction bill that literally would have provided funds to shore up Minneapolis's and Minnesota's bridges. And the reason he did it was it included a tax increase. And it is absolute dogma on the conservative side and in the Republican Party that every tax increase always and everywhere has to be fought. Well, our infrastructure is crumbling. I mean, our wastewater infrastructure, according to the American Society of Civil Engineers, you know, rates a D-. And so, you know, the hidden costs of the conservative policy of no tax increases ever are beginning to come due. They're beginning to come due. And just like, you know, in the 1960s and the 1970s, maybe some of the hidden costs of the blind spots of the liberal ideology were beginning to come due, and that, you know, liberals really didn't have any answer to the electorate for the rising crime rates. You know, what goes around comes around, and we really do seem to be coming to the end of this era I call Nixon land. But then again, as a historian, I'm not very comfortable predicting the future, so I do take a kind of a wait-and-see attitude. But this does seem to be the alignment of political and cultural forces that we're observing right now in 2008.
Well, the book, if you'd like to read it, is Nixon Land, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America, published by Scribner, by our guest Rick Perlstein. And thanks very much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure.
WILO programming made possible by Columbia Street Roastery, roasting coffee daily at 24 East Columbia in Champaign, also offering a variety of tea and chai. Open Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5:15 p.m. and Saturday mornings from 9 to noon. More information available at 352-9713. We will break, as we usually do, for an update on the markets and news. Then we'll be back, so please stay tuned.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by AgriGold Hybrids, funding agricultural programming as an additional service to the many AgriGold customers in the AM 580 listening area. AgriGold, the corn specialists. More information is at agrigold.com or at 800-262-7333.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets. We're at mid-session. Corn and soybeans going in opposite direction. The corn futures contracts to the downside of the opening bell while soybeans are rallying. Let's look at the particulars. We'll begin at the Chicago Board of Trade with July corn at 675 and three quarters, down 7 1/4. September, 687, down 7 3/4. December, 705, down 7 3/4. March of 2009, 721 1/4, down 8 1/2. July beans, 1595, up 17. August, 1584 1/2, up 12 1/2. September, 1579, up 14 1/4. November, 1572 1/2, up 15 1/2. July soybean meal, 438.50, up $3. July soybean oil, 63.95, up 17. July wheat at the Board of Trade, 805.